Good afternoon, everybody. We're in the session to look at future longevity research and product development in the Australian retirement income market. The background to this session was in late 2008, the Life Insurance Wealth Management Practice Committee instigated about six research groups to look into various areas. Unsuccessfully, we only got membership for about one of those groups, which happens to be our current topic, longevity, or Sue's saying there's a second group. No paper to be presented yet. Today we have two of the members of the committee up on stage, Francis Burgess and Eric McNamara. The other members of the committee, I'm not sure if they're all here. Aaron Brune, Mike Wang, Sue Howes and Robert Hartnett. So Robert Hartnett from PwC, Sue Howes an independent consultant, Aaron works at ANU, Mike Wang previously worked at Ingevity and he's doing contracting work at the moment. Eric McNamara, one of our speakers, is from Deloitte, works in the financial services area. He qualified in 2003 as a UK fellow and has been working in Australia for 7 years as he sins. He specialises in product innovation and longevity issues. He was the lead actuary in the development of the CPF longevity insurance product and has worked closely with other organisations in assisting to develop strategies and products to address longevity issues. Francis Burgess, who's known to many people in the room as well, is an actuary at RGA. He works on research and market development. He qualified in 2000 as a UK fellow and has also been working in Australia for 7 years. His role within RGA involves product development and non-traditional reinsurance opportunities in the Australian and New Zealand markets. He was a pricing actuary for both the Guaranteed Index Tracker Annuity in Australia and the Annuity Growth Account in the UK. Now, today's presentation will be about a 10-minute presentation from Francis, followed by 15 minutes from Eric, and then we'll look to open up to questions from the floor. So I'll throw across to Francis to get started.
Thank you, James. We're keenly aware that we've got the after-lunch slot, and the topic is longevity. It's all about the risk of overrunning, so I'll make sure that I'm very quick on what we go through in terms of a quick overview of what's in the paper. But the real purpose for today's session is actually to engineer a debate about what the next step should be for the research group. So the first part of the paper was really talking about the need for research into longevity. I think we're all aware in the Australian market, lifetime annuities have practically ceased to be sold. Technically, they're still open to new business, but I think you probably found about 100 lifetime annuities were sold last year. The other main issues that we have is that there's no standard table for pensioner mortality or annuitant mortality in Australia. This means that in order to price products, we will need to look at overseas tables, look at mortality and longevity trends overseas. And when we do so, we obviously run the risk that we need to modify those tables, understand the need for those modifications and how mortality might differ and also mortality improvement might differ between different companies and countries. This need to extrapolate and understand overseas trends gets us to sort of look at what is the actual mortality improvements and what are the actual base mortality in different countries and try and get a better view of what those are about. A lot of that time that actually involves looking at things of how countries can differ. So one major impact that's addressed in the paper looks at smoking prevalence and how that has changed from different countries to different countries and how that's led to different mortality improvement. So the paper goes through what actual overseas tables exist at the moment, and I think the summary of the conclusion of the paper is that there's absolutely no real Australian table at the moment that enables you to adequately price and reserve for these type of longevity products. There's a series of UK tables that are based on annuitant mortality. They're a different country. They're in either the 80s or the 2000 series, so they're quite a bit out of date. And there's a whole reason of technical reasons why those tables might need further modification. The only real Australian sort of base table that could be used is the insured mortality table. That table, again, is basically looking at term assurances rather than annuities, and the age of that is also quite sort of inappropriate. There are some further sort of studies and source data that's also addressed in the paper, but the key conclusions are that for one reason or another, there really isn't a base table or a mortality improvement basis in Australia that can be used for product development. I think I've gone slightly far. The next part of the paper looks at different countries, and there'll be a couple of pretty graphs coming up pretty shortly. I found that this paper is actually sort of taken from the Princeton report, and I found this paper one of the most useful pieces of sort of research to getting my understanding in this market. It's in the reference sections of the paper, but I would recommend it very highly. If you want a very quick snapshot of how different mortality improvements can be found across the globe, this report is an excellent starting point and source. It also looks at different trends. So there's basically three. This is more about mortality improvements. So it looks at various developing countries from the 1950s onwards and gets some sort of idea as to how the mortality improvements factors have occurred, both on a age-attained and sort of a cohort and birth year process. And it identifies basically three different types of trends. The first one, let's see if I can try this one more time. I'll wait for the technician in the back still. Oh, thanks. So this is the pretty sort of heat map chart that is just probably worth explaining for in a little bit more. The actual Princeton report has these heat maps for a numerous number of countries, but I think it's worth sort of just understanding what we're looking for here before we move on. So what you've got along the bottom is basically the birth year of the people, either males on the left, females on the right. You've got the age on the left hand side, and then the birth cohort will be basically diagonals along this chart. So the red scale basically indicates a very high mortality improvement factor. And the blue indicates a negative mortality improvement or actually a mortality deterioration. Now, the mortality improvements actually illustrate three different types of trends, and they illustrate them very graphically. First one would be a period or age attained trend. So this relates to a particular group of people who are all born in the same year, and it tracks them through as they get older. So in that particular case, you're looking at diagonals. The perhaps the most sort of prevalent diagonal, if you look at the male chart, would be those people that were born in the sort of 1930s, 1940s. And you can see that the mortality improvement for this group is the best of any. So that's that large red diagonal you can see there. That illustrates a trend which is basically a period or age-attained trend. A cohort or year of birth trend. The other one is an age of 10 trend, and that goes from left to right. And that basically is something that would happen for a particular age group. And then the last one is a structure or calendar year trend, and that's basically a trend that would happen in a particular year. So the reds and the blues, you can get an idea of some sort of the event that occurs. So whilst the paper doesn't actually speculate on causes, I think it's a reasonable assertion to make that you can perhaps see the incidence of motor vehicle accidents coming through in the 1960s to the 1970s in that column where it's bluer than average, and in particular blue around the sort of the mid-20s sort of mark. The other thing you can see is the impact of AIDS in the late 80s around the 30s sort of age group. And you can see the difference between the male and the female mortality for this. Where the Princeton report actually becomes extremely useful, if you're determining what longevity assumptions are, is where you can actually compare and contrast different countries. In the presentation today, we're just looking at Australia and UK, and it's insightful to see that the same 1930-1934 cohort effect occurs. So what's this seeing is that, generally speaking, the UK, if you look at these sort of heat maps, is actually quite a good indicator of what the experience you would get in the Australia. So the practice of using the IM80 and the 2000 series UK annuity tables is perhaps not that bad idea. However, you can see that there's still quite large differences between various different age groups and stuff between the two countries, and therefore some quite considerable degree of caution should be used when applying UK sort of experience to Australia. You can also see quite clearly here the effect of what's called the 1930 to 34 cohort, which is very prevalent in the UK research, which shows that those people born in the birth year 1930-34 have had the best mortality improvement of any other cohort, quite markedly so. That actually is the cohort, if you think about it. Lifetime annuities are mainly in their 70s now, given when the product was sold. That's actually the cohort for which most lifetime annuity valuation bases will be referring to. These are the only two I've got here for the quick, brief sort of summary here. But the paper actually goes through quite a few more countries, and the original Princeton report goes into a whole more than that. The interesting thing is a lot of the developed countries all show similar patterns, but the one I particularly like is the East German one, where you can actually see the fall of the Berlin Wall quite clearly in the heat map. And also the Japanese heat map is basically a blur of different shades of red, which indicates that you probably don't want to be selling lifetime annuities to the Japanese. The next part of the paper just again goes back to the exact tables that are used. So it talks about population tables, it talks about the UK annuity 18,000 series, also brings out some UK pension scheme data and contrasts the population and life table data from Australia. Again, the conclusion of the paper is that there's basically none of these tables are suitable for any pricing of longevity risk in Australia without significant modification, and that we really are in a situation where without a sort of a standard table, it's very difficult for people in the product development and also in the capital allocation of these products to do so efficiently. So the main reason, for the research that's been brought out here is that we do need a standard table in order to really help assist product development. I think we also need a standard table to make sure that people are allocating the appropriate amount of capital to the product. Without industry-wide sort of experience analysis, people will obviously take extremely prudent assumptions when coming up with base mortality and also mortality improvement assumptions, and that will lead to a less attractive pricing for the Australians and more expensive for the consumer. Okay, I think that's where the first part of the double act ends. I'm going to hand over to my colleague to finish you through the presentation, and we'll take some questions. Thank you.
Okay, the next part of the paper really goes into the different types of products that are currently available. As Francis had said, the main reason for the committee or task force is to pull together everything that's available Australia and globally, so that we can take a bit of a temperature check and say this is where we're at, and then as a group decide how we're going to move forward. So I'll run through this quite quickly. Allocated pensions, we all know them well. Flexible and importantly for Australians, allow bequest. Francis already had spoken about the sort of decline in the lifetime annuity. I guess lifetime annuities have just seemed to be too expensive and not flexible enough. We looked at product innovation, primarily at the Astron product and the sort of low take-up rates there. Certainly an innovative product, but the market hasn't quite grabbed it, maybe as was going to be expected. We looked at Acton North, which is effectively a pre-retirement variable annuity, a GMAB for those who are familiar with it, guaranteed accumulation benefit. We think, though, there's scope for a lot more development in this area. There's a lot of discussion, but we're yet to see anything get any real traction. If we compare it to like sort of US, Japan, or UK, where there's been some more significant traction in this sort of like product innovation area. And also with recent events and the global meltdown, it's people are much more aware of the need to have innovative products that can be more robust in downturns. Again, just the paper fleshes out the issues that we face in more detail. It goes through the sort of target income replacement ratios. I believe Senator Sherris was targeting 65%. And we sort of thought a bit about, sort of the education and the awareness that really people talk about going to their financial planner in their 50s and what do I do with post-retirement when it begins in your 20s. I mean, if you're going to be targeting 65% replacement ratio, it's sort of getting your plans together at a much younger age. We looked at sort of people's awareness of the effect of inflation on income levels and the needs for real assets. And are people really aware of this? Planners, a lot of financial planners are just advising their clients to take the minimum level of drawdown from their allocated pension. I'm sure that is in some ways a hedge against longevity, but is it effective and is it optimised? Well, we'd say no, really. So there has to be a better solution than that kind of approach. And in terms of actually the education as well, on part of our work when we were developing the CPF longevity insurance product, and this is a bit of a plug for my talk on Wednesday morning, if anyone's around, but one of the things we encountered, and I'm sure it's the same in Australia, is people fundamentally didn't believe that they were living longer. They tend to look at sort of the expectation of life of a newborn baby and say, well, look, this is 75, 80 or whatever it is, and I'm now 65, so I don't need to worry about it. Whereas it's trying to get people educated about sort of conditional probabilities of living, and if you've lived to 65 or 70, the sort of expected future lifetime of you is a lot different. And that was a very difficult exercise, and we met a lot of sort of people saying, well, with like unhealthy eating and all these kind of things, I'm sure we're actually going to live a lot shorter. Quite a difficult exercise to actually get that point across. I'm not sure how prevalent that is in Australia, but certainly there will be some level of that, I would imagine. The other thing then we looked at was to come up with some sort of criteria about how to look at the problem. Now, we stole these criteria, I think, from Matterson 2007, I believe it was. But it just sort of raised some interesting points about, protect the downside. And I think that's a very obvious point, in particular when we've seen recent events where people who are in retirement effectively have investments being smashed heavily and allow them no real way to earn future income to actually replace that loss. I mean, so what are they going to do now? In terms of having capital protection, upside, and income generation, which sounds very familiar to like with-profit products that sort of lost their place, so maybe we've turned full circle. A shift into more aggressive assets, and certainly I think this is probably more appropriate in Australia than other countries with the age pension. I mean, it should, to a certain extent, facilitate you taking more risk in that other countries in Asia, for example, have no sort of safety net. And obviously they have to be much more conservative. Interestingly as well, variable annuities do go a long way to addressing point 2 and 3 in terms of capital protection and allowing a move into more aggressive assets. But again, they've yet to really get traction in Australia outside of the pre-retirement sort of AXA North products. And then allowing guarantees into existing allocated pensions. And I guess that really is what the Astron product is trying to do. So we've seen that to a certain extent, but we've yet to see it being taken en masse. We sort of, as part of the task force, had sort of brainstorming sessions on the rest of the world and sort of what we could learn and sort of how we could try and sort of facilitate that sort of implementation in Australia. We looked at pensions, and of course, I guess, well, the way it used to be, up to about 6 months ago, was a defined benefit pension scheme was great for the consumer in terms of you had a safety net for life. But, my mother's American, my dad's Irish, and I can tell you now, a lot of the government pension funds in Ireland are at 50% funding levels or less. And they're really looking at the distinct possibility to have to cut pensions. So, I mean, the probably number one attraction of defined benefit pension funds for a lot of people is in a serious doubt at this moment in time if they can't find ways to get out of the hole that they're currently in. Looking at annuities, because annuities overseas have gotten quite interesting in places, and I'm not talking about variable annuities, but in terms of annuities with death benefits, with profit annuities, drawdown annuities, they, regardless of how you look at them, they only really seem to be successful when they're compulsory, like sort of UK defined contribution or sort of some of the US systems. If they're not compulsory, they don't seem to generate large markets, and when they do, it's difficult because you have such selective problems with obviously only people who want to buy them or at least perceive themselves to be extremely healthy. Otherwise, I mean, you wouldn't really do it. We looked at reverse mortgages and, again, complex products like a lot of the more innovative products. It doesn't really hedge in longevity, just, I guess, is a tool to get cash out of your home. Severely bad political press in the UK when people were left with negative equity, and in Australia, that's why companies have given no negative equity guarantees, which, for those that don't know, it's when the sort of value of the loan is bigger than your assets, and you have, you know, pensioners being asked to front up money they don't actually have, and it makes the current affair today, tonight, and, you know, everybody, you know, is after you. There was real problems around that. We do understand that they were launched in India in 2006, and that the view in India they're going to be potentially a very big product over there, so keep monitoring that. And then, I guess, variable annuities, which have sold very well, in particularly America and Japan, but you know they do have high fees. Some people do say they've sold well in the States because the commissions were so high to advisors. However, they probably are one of the better products for addressing all of the kind of criteria that in the previous slide we talked about. You know, Hartford, though, one of the biggest providers of those products in the world, just announced a $5 billion loss a few months ago on their variable annuity product suite. And I mean, they should know what they're doing. So it does show from their product provider's point of view some of the risks that there is. And there, I mean, other issues that the product provider has is you can hedge the actual guarantee to the individual, but it doesn't necessarily reduce the volatility in your accounts and your P&L and your balance sheet. So even though you actually do all the hedging properly, you could actually have real problems on your reporting side. And then we looked a bit at mortality bonds and swaps. And I mean, this is probably one of the most interesting areas, you know, I guess, in its infancy. But you know, if you're writing risk business and mortality improves more than expected, and you get experienced profits, you know, if you're a pension fund, you get experienced losses. Surely there's a market to develop that sort of swapping those kind of positions to manage your mortality risk more. I guess longevity bonds, another good way, particularly for pension funds, to manage risks. And if you have an investment and mortality improves more than expected and your investment improves, that's the ideal thing as a pension fund that you want to be holding. So really, I mean, there really is room for those sort of types of products to develop more. But again, we've seen some, I guess, we looked at 2003, the Swiss Re mortality bond, and we looked at the PNB 2004 longevity bond. But, I mean, we had a good look, and there isn't that much out there on this topic. In terms of futures, well, probably need more of a reliable mortality index before that market can develop further. But again, a very interesting area to look at. And probably sort of a point to sort of finish on is in terms of one of the things we've thought about is, you know, from an actuarial point of view, a lot of these products are very interesting or can address a lot of the issues that we face. But, you know, as well, when all said and done, planners have to sell them. And a lot of them are highly complex, and it's quite difficult to get them to sell complex products they're not used to selling. And I know all the other sort of issues that come with statements of advice and selling. So all these issues will have to be addressed, and we have to develop better tools for people to understand the issues, and not just actuaries, but sort of people who don't have our depth of technical knowledge as well. Otherwise, there's no real future. I think this last slide, Francis, you already talked about at the beginning, but to reiterate Francis's point, we just thought, you know, yes, there's overseas data, but, you know, the heat maps Francis showed, you can see, yes, there's similarities, but there's also a lot of differences. We kind of felt we either need some sort of Australian industry study, I mean, further than the Mercer study, but where everyone contributes and we can actually get a real handle on what kind of sort of longevity issues we're seeing as an industry. What obviously is a huge piece of work, but it's something that sort of we need to look at in depth. And the other thing is maybe through the census data, we can sort of try and pull out some socio-economic indicators and start develop from the ground up socio-economic segmented table. But again, potentially a large piece of work. But I'll stop talking now, because one of the things we want to achieve today is people's opinions on what we should be doing as a committee and also what your experiences are, and I guess fundamentally if you agree or disagree with what we're saying. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric and Francis. I guess at this stage, the committee and the task force really just wants to open up to some dialogue, and probably to start with, does anyone have any questions or feedback they'd like to give on the presentation at this stage? I know because everyone's running at the same time, but anyone, please, just to start the ball going, otherwise I might have to choose someone.
Gardner, at the last financial forum we had that really good paper by Chris White and Anne Wilson. I wondered if you'd studied that much.
I didn't quite hear the full question, but I think it referred to a paper from the last forum.
Yeah, by Chris White and Anne Wilson, because I went to the discussion on that, and that was a very interesting discussion.
No, I don't believe any of us have looked at that one, but we certainly will do.
Hi, Tony Boffinger. First of all, a comment, or I guess it's all comments actually. First one being, you know, with due respect to Wade, I would have some caution about using his list of criteria for appropriate product solutions on the basis that obviously his company sells certain product solutions and his criteria may be somewhat weighted towards what his product satisfies. So I just think there might be a broader range of criteria we need to look at. The other thing, I think I agree with your comments about compulsion on lifetime annuities. I think the problem is that there is obviously longevity and investment risk that is currently being borne by the individual and the government. Whether the government is aware or not, it has written both a financial market and a longevity put on the Australian population. Both the bearers of that risk are mispricing it, and so if one has the appropriate tools to price it properly, and I guess if one errs on the side of pricing it conservatively, if you don't have the appropriate tools, then that necessarily makes your price look very expensive and people don't want it. So I think you're right that lifetime annuities just don't work without compulsion, and you know, it will be interesting to see what comes out of the Henry Review on that side, given it was one of their specific questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that, Tony. Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the products at the moment, the lifetime annuities that were written, there's probably, you know, a tiny handful of policies that are sold now. And you know, you talk to people, and they also base their expectation, their future lifetime on you know, how long their mum or dad lasted, or how long their grandparents lasted, and that sort of idea of how long their future mortality is going to be compared to what the value they might get from a lifetime annuity means that product, although technically open still in this market, has sold just a handful of policies.
But it's also quite difficult to see the next rung of product development that would have to come out of Australia without at least some sort of idea what the sort of standard longevity basis might be for some of the next wave, the next generation of these products. And I suppose really that's what this group is all about. So thank you, Tony.
And that sort of feeds as well into the point I made about when we were doing the implementation on a longevity product in Singapore, where we experienced real problems just sort of convincing the general public that they were living longer. They fundamentally just did not believe it. So I guess understanding your own longevity is a big part of it, because ultimately people have to buy these things.
Roland Cummings, do you think that there is enough data in Australia that if we put it all together we would have enough for an experience study? And if you do, then how would you go about convincing companies to actually contribute towards that experience study? One of the things that we did when we did the lump sum experience study with IFSA was that we asked all the companies if they were interested in contributing their annuitant data in order to do one, and every single company said no.
Perhaps if we can sort of address the first question, which is there enough data, and then address the second question, which is the difficulty with the experience studies. On the data, I think there's probably two questions there, really, if I can break it down. Is there enough data for a base mortality assumption? And secondly, is there enough data for a mortality improvement assumption? Now, in terms of the base mortality, I think probably the best place to look would be the lifetime annuity products. That's certainly got the largest amount of experience for a base mortality product. Each company probably doesn't have enough. There's probably several number of major providers who were not active now, but were active at the time. Each of those companies probably has enough to get a partially credible view of what's going on, but they wouldn't understand perhaps the variances that might occur from company to company. But they'd certainly have enough to get a view of what perhaps an evaluation assumption should be. In terms of the mortality improvements, though, I think we're struggling. No company has any chance of having credible data that would come up with a mortality improvement assumption. Even if you pulled all of the companies together in the Australian market, you're still probably getting only partially the way there. So if you were sort of expecting, you know, maybe 100 or so deaths a year or whatever the number is, you know, the difference in mortality improvement might only be a few, and therefore the noise sort of factor comes in and swamps it. And even if you put all the mortality together, you're still going to have quite a bit of uncertainty in that assumption. In terms of people's willingness to contribute, I mean, I'm aware of the track record in Australia of those sort of issues, especially on a voluntary basis. I would have thought, though, there's probably a few incentives for companies to put those data together. Currently, the capital standards and the amount of capital that may be allocated to these products certainly reflects, I would say, the data or the lack of it in Australia. And there therefore might be quite a strong capital motivation for companies to get a better idea of only, first of all, the mortality base and also the mortality improvement assumption. Do you have anything to add?
I guess in terms of on the company's willingness, it is always a difficult thing because it takes a fair bit of time to put together. And I guess one aspect feeds into the other in terms of if we're going down the road of writing more products in the future that introduce the large tail risks if you get your mortality wrong, then there's going to be more of an onus on people and companies to actually contribute to a study that's going to improve your pricing. I mean, it would be foolish not to do so. Where that equilibrium point is, obviously we don't know. We're just trying to bring together a body of people, information, and for the profession to preempt things now, because ultimately, I mean, there has to be some changes in the market. So that's kind of our view, which I guess isn't a full answer, but that's where our discussion's been going.
Andrew Goy. A thing I've been thinking about a reasonable amount recently, is because I'm not too far distant, will be retiring. It is nothing like that to sort of confront somebody and think about what the issues are. One of the ideas that I've come up with, and I think there's a product over in the US, and I think you might have touched on it in your paper as well, is that we've got an allocated pension mentality here now, basically. We've got a lot of life officers sitting around, happy to take in their assets under management fees, but never take any other risk that they used to years ago. The problem for the individual is that they keep having to be so conservative because they might live till they're 110. And this is a sort of an idea put out by the actuaries and, I believe, the advisors. So I think what one really needs in this situation is this concept of longevity insurance, which is basically, so I've got my allocated pension, I can think in terms of a fixed term. If you can give me something at a reasonable price, at 60, say, and I'd be looking for something, many years ago I might have been happy to pay a 5% single premium fee for investing in something. If you can give me something that I can get away with less than 5% at an age, now I don't care what it is at the moment, 90, 95, just give me an age where you'll offer me a single premium product where possibly I don't have to sort of insure myself against the full income stream that I might be expecting and running off the capital on the allocated pension, but just some sort of underpin, like comfortable life might be, if it's obviously not the age pension, but something from the Westpac ASFA retirement study, maybe I think a comfortable one there for a single person is something of the order of $35,000 a year. Maybe if you want to load something in on top of that, three times the age pension or whatever, might be a reasonable sort of product. That way, I got more flexibility in managing my allocated annuity over the fixed term, and I know that in the end of the day, if I run out, I try not to run out, but if I do, at least I've got some sort of backup mechanism at a certain point in time in the future. Now, I guess one thing I'd like to refer to here, the group, is that I don't know whether the fact that you don't have a mortality study for Australia, I don't know whether that's actually... it almost seems as if it's stopping product innovation. I don't see any product innovation at all. I've seen this Alice product, but it's a bundled sort of product, so I wouldn't trust a bundled product anymore. I want an unbundled situation with an allocated pension and possibility of an insurance for the tail. And at the moment, your lifetime immediate annuities, for example, people make assumptions in pricing, and the tail of a lifetime immediate annuity is exactly the thing that one would be looking at. Say, at 90, 85, 90, 95, depending on what price you're prepared to pay. So I'll just sort of throw that. I guess the sort of almost rhetorical question is it really the fact that we don't have this mortality study, is that really stopping product innovation, or is it really the fact that everyone's living off the assets under management fees and don't want to take on any more risk in Australia?
Yeah, I think there's some better points there. Probably a couple of comments I might sort of add to that. The first one would be that the sort of deferred annuity sort of product you're talking about, which kicks in sort of as an insurance along the tail line of really living longer, is precisely the point where from a product development point of view, it becomes very dangerous for an insurance company to price it. So if you've got some idea of what mortality is now, you don't know what the mortality improvement is going to be in 5-10 years, if you're sort of selling a product that sells for a very small proportion of the fund balance, a single premium product, then that's where you really are exposed to the mortality improvement assumption. As a pricing actuary, that's just very, very scary. I completely agree with you from a customer need point of view, but from a sort of the pricing actuarial point of view, it's extremely difficult. The mortality improvement sort of data from around the world suggested that you could come up with a mortality assumption of anywhere between -2 and 8 and argue it either way along that spectrum. Obviously, there's a middle ground is the obvious one, but you know, putting those two mortality improvement assumptions into that product would lead to vastly different pricing outcomes. And I think it's that pricing uncertainty that's led to a hesitation in the market to offer those sort of terms.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Andrew,
in terms of like product innovation, some of the modern products are very sensitive to mortality. Some actually are like quite insensitive to mortality changes. So it depends on the type of products that you're looking for. In terms of longevity insurance, well, I'd say I advise it to come along Wednesday morning to our CPF talk, where we go into detail on longevity products, Andrew. But our experience was to make longevity insurance successful, you need government compulsion. You need to have enough scale so that you can provide in such a way that you don't have hefty cost of guarantees and that you can iron out fluctuations. So I guess maybe in some ways, yeah, Andrew, I agree with you. Maybe for some products, the mortality table isn't the issue. But if that isn't the issue, there'll be another bigger issue in terms of, you know, wide acceptance, potentially government compulsion. And I don't know if we're quite there yet or if that's something Australia's ready for. So I think one of the problems I have with the longevity discussions, they're very interesting, but a lot of the issues are embedded in each other. So it's very hard to take them in isolation. You sort of need to consider them all together. But again, we'll discuss this a lot further in depth on Wednesday morning at that session.
Hi, Melinda House from ASFA. I think a couple of other things that is holding back the product innovation at the moment is there's some tax problems, some legislative roadblocks, which means the insurance part of these products aren't taxed very nicely at the moment, in super anyway. And the other thing is, I think, a lack of long-term index bonds to back them, as has already been mentioned. But I think we will see some compulsion coming in. The government's very aware that they've written those put options and they're starting to see the costs of the market downside put they've written right now because there's so many more people getting onto a partial age pension. So we think at ASFA we will see some sort of compulsion at some stage to ensure for people to insure their own longevity risk. So that would obviously drive momentum in this market, which would be a good thing.
Melinda, could I ask you a question sort of on behalf of the committee just before we go? The research group has really taken the perspective of trying to take it from the angle of, I guess, their employers and see what's holding back development of products, and it's the traditional actuarial sense about having mortality tables. You've mentioned several other aspects. Is this something you'd like the research groups to look at and bundle up some sort of issues papers, or is this something that ASFA's looking at themselves?
We are looking at it, and we've got a retirement outcomes working group. It's something the Henry Task Force have looked at, and they've been asking people responding to that for what are all the roadblocks from product innovation in this area. So I think they're also pretty aware of these issues. They'd be the guys to get that list into, definitely, if you've got more things to add. ASFA would be interested in seeing it too.
Okay. Anthony?
A few more comments.
Actually, you might just make this quick. I think we're at the last bell, Tony.
Okay, very quick, because the first thing I wanted to say was Andrew's obviously very organised because he can't be that close to retirement. But from an institute point of view, I think Melinda referred to the Retirement Incomes Task Force and the Henry Review submission that was made. That actually argued against compulsory lifetime annuities. So I think, you know, potentially the institute needs to make a global decision on, you know, what it actually thinks is a way forward, because, there's obviously some conflict going on there.
Any closing comments, Eric Francis?
I think conflicting issues is a big part of it, yeah. That's a fair point. And one of the reasons amongst many why this committee came together is that to get a unified opinion. We know that will take some time, and also to work with other committees or groups as and when necessary. But, this is just our first introducing ourselves and sort of letting you know where we're at and taking a temperature check, as I said. I mean, the big work is yet to be done.
Yeah, thanks for those comments. I suppose the purpose of this was really an introduction. The research group is only a few months old. But what we were trying to get here is an idea of the scope of the research. So from that scope, we were looking at providing information to two groups. One, sort of actuaries and audit prices of products, because we know that the lack of information is a hindrance to product development. And the other one was really to provide information to the public in order to educate them about these issues, in order to get over some of the perception issues that also are hindering product development and people's appetites. And those are the two areas which we wanted to focus on and where we want to have our scope. and in doing that, be a sort of an area where you could focus all the research and an access point for these sort of products. But I don't think really was in the scope to particularly address any particular mandate around compulsion or anything else like that. So those are probably more personal comments.
Okay, so in closing, I'd just like to say probably any feedback that anyone has after the meeting, please just be prepared to throw an email to either Francis or Eric or get in touch with them as representatives of the committee. And I'd just like to, if everyone could...